May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Hi, everybody. I'm Ramona from Oklahoma. And I'm a member of the Okmulgee Oklahoma Al-Anon Group. And I'm grateful to be a member of the Okmulgee Oklahoma Al-Anon Group. I'm grateful to be a member of Al-Anon. And I'm very grateful to be in Santa Cruz, California. That goes to show what this program will do for an Okie. I never dreamed that I'd get to make a trip like this. It's been beautiful. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, because it's always a privilege to me to get to share just a little bit of what I've received so much of. I want to thank Pauline for loaning her van and Barbara for driving it. So we got a sightseeing tour yesterday. And then I thought, well, today will never come. And here I am. You didn't bring me here to take a sightseeing tour. You didn't bring me here to tell jokes. I believe you brought me here to share my experience, my strength, and my hope, as somebody shared theirs with me. You know, I am an Oklahoma Indian, and I'm sort of proud of it. And before I ever left the teepee, my father took me aside, and he said, Ramona, don't cut your hair. And then my mother took me away, and she said, Ramona, don't share your blanket. And then I met the great white father. And that's what we're going to talk about today. The biggest battle one Indian and one cowboy ever had in the state of Oklahoma. Well, you see, I was born and raised on a ranch. And when I started looking around, you know, I got that age. And I was looking around for somebody, for Ramona. You know what I looked for? A cowboy. And I found a pair of high-heel cowboy boots and a big cowboy hat and some sparkling blue eyes, and he didn't have a chance. There was another white man bit the dust. Well, we got married, and I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, and we moved to a ranch. What I didn't know was that there were three of us at the wedding ceremony. There was Bob, Jim Beam, and me. Oh, Bob loved Jim Beam. He never could decide between Jim Beam and me. Well, I knew that when we moved to the ranch, that everything would be just great. You know, his drinking didn't bother me. Not a bit. He was a rather quiet person, and when he drank, he talked. And, you know, on Saturday night, we'd go to town and buy the week's groceries, and then we'd go to a honky-tonk and meet all the other cowboys, and everybody drank, and, Bob was a doll. He just said all sorts of funny, cute things, and he really danced well, you know, when he was drinking. And then when we got home, he was very affectionate. And I liked that. Well, you know how the story of drinking goes. Alcoholism is a disease, and it's a family illness. It is not just confined to the one who drinks it. I did not know my husband was a victim of this disease. I did not know it was a family illness. And I did not know that I would become sicker than he did, quicker. All I knew was that the more he drank, he wasn't himself anymore. And we went out on Saturday night, like we used to, and we got the groceries, and we went to the honky-tonk, and he said all those funny things, and everybody else laughed. And I didn't. They weren't funny to me. I wanted to take him home. We didn't dance because we didn't both keep the same rhythm. We got home and he wanted to be affectionate. And I refused to have any of that. So I slept on the couch. Now state that a little differently. I stayed awake on the couch. And he immediately went to sleep in bed. It didn't bother him a bit. And I would lie there all night and think of all the things I was going to tell him the next morning about what he did. So I would awaken him at 6:30 to talk sense. Do you know what you did last night? Well, just in case you don't know, I'm going to tell you. And he'd say, leave me alone. I wasn't about to do that. No, I knew that when I could get him to see what he was doing, he wouldn't do it anymore. And it was my responsibility as a good wife to educate him. The drinking progressed. There is no way in this disease of alcoholism, if you are practicing, it will not progress. There's no way. And they tell me that it's true that you don't have to be drinking for the disease to progress, that this is one of the peculiarities of the disease of alcoholism. Well, I knew that I could fix something, always fix something. And then when I found the magic key, he wouldn't have to drink anymore. I knew this. So I started in changing everything about us, everything around us. I never thought of changing me, because he said there wasn't anything wrong with me. And if you didn't think so, ask me. I tell you there was nothing wrong with me. I made one damn fatal mistake. I married a cowboy. But I'd straighten him up, and then everything would be all right. I decided what we needed was a child. I mean, we couldn't run around so much anymore. We'd be settled down. We'd be a family. So I got very busy on this little project. And I had a baby daughter. I guess I thought it was the Immaculate Conception. And I was so proud of myself, I'd done it all. And I said, here's your baby. And now we're going to be a little family. And we're going to live on the ranch. And you're going to raise the cattle and quarter horses. And everything's going to be great. And you know what? Bob and the baby and I got along beautifully. And so did Bob and Jim Beam. And nothing changed. And that baby was only 6 months old when I took my first trip home to Mother over a drinking bout. The first one of many. I continued. I decided the problem was we needed a son. I thought having babies, you know, you wouldn't be a drunk if you had a lot of babies, I guess. But every man needs a son. And then he'd be the kind of father he wanted to be, you know. So I got busy again. And I prayed so hard to God, give me a boy. Give Bob a son. And I had that baby boy. Little old black-headed fat Indian baby. And I said, here you are. You've got a daughter, you've got a son, you've got a ranch, you've got cattle, and above all, you've got me. And you don't have to drink anymore. Bob loved us all. That I did not know. But you see, my husband was an alcoholic. And he drank. I got so sick. I got so frightened. I got so alone. And there was nothing else to change. I moved us. In town and out of town. 10 miles. That was all the money we had for a geographical cure. But I always knew that around us I could change something. and he wouldn't have to drink. The loneliness of the disease of alcoholism. I'm not talking about the one that just drinks it. I'm talking about the one that becomes sick because we live with it. The loneliness. I would look at him and think, why can't you hear what I say? And he'd look at me, and I know he thought, why can't you shut your mouth? You know, the loss of communication in a family where there's the disease of alcoholism. This is so sad. I lost communication with the alcoholic quickly. He didn't hear a word I said because he was in a prison. A wall had been built between us, a big, solid, hard wall. And it had been built of resentment and fear and guilt and remorse. And he was on his side, sick, and I was on my side, sick, and neither one of us understood anything that the other one said. So we couldn't talk anymore. And then the children. This is something that's very, very important to me. Are the children in a family where there's the disease of alcoholism. This boy and this girl that we both love so much. They understood their father. It was very simple. You see, Daddy drank that and he did this. That was all there was to it. Daddy wouldn't do it if he didn't drink. But what about Mother? Mother would go into a screaming rage and tantrum, and she wasn't drinking. The scars that were left on our two children, their father did not put there. I put there. And they are grown children today, and they both carry the scars. But you see, I don't have to worry about that, not anymore. Because I found a program, and I found a way to live. And this program says that I can make amends. And the way I make amends is going someplace, wherever I'm asked, and someone letting me share my experience with them. Because I know in my heart today that somewhere in this room, there's a young mother. And that mother is doing the same things I used to do. And she's doing them because she hurts. She's alone. She's scared. And she doesn't know what else to do. And I can say, but you don't have to do that. You don't have to do the things I did. You see, there's a program called Al-Anon. And there are people there who understand you. There are people there who will love you. There were people there who will walk with you. And you don't have to do what I did. And you don't have to hurt like I did. And in that way, I get to make amends. I make amends because you allow me the honor and privilege of making amends. And I'm very grateful. Let me just tell you, I'll just give you a little example of what kind of a mother I was. You know, I had a thing about Bob eating. I think all of us that are married to alcoholics, practicing or non-practicing, have a thing about, have you eaten? Don't forget to eat your breakfast, eat your supper. Well, I had a great big thing about eating. And it was a big deal in our house. Will you be home for supper? What time will you be home for supper? You damn well better get home for supper. Well, this was an evening, and now this happened many times. This was a ritual. And I had fixed dinner, and the children were in the kitchen. They were home from school, and I had everything ready and cooking and doing. And we were laughing and having a marvelous time. And Daddy walked in the back door. And he walked through the kitchen, and he looked over at me and grinned and said, hi. And one of those blue eyes didn't look at me quite straight. He walked right on through the bedroom, the kitchen, and into the bedroom and laid down to take a short nap. And I hauled off and kicked the refrigerator, threw the things in the floor and said, damn him, I'll kill him. And the kids look at me and say, what's the matter? Well, by this time I've sailed out of the kitchen and I'm down to the bedroom. And I look at him and I said, what do you think you're doing? He said, I'm taking a nap. I said, not in my house, you don't. You don't come home drunk and pass out on my bed. So he gets up and he puts his hat on and he starts back out the door. And I'm right behind him. And I said, and where in the hell are you going? And he said to get some sleep. And I said, if I ever catch you in bed with somebody else, I'll kill you. By this time, he's out to his pickup, and he's driving down the driveway, and the kids are behind me, and I'm screaming at him, don't you ever come back. If you come back, I'll kill you. I hate you. And he's gone. He never looked back. The neighbors all hear this. I go back in the kitchen, and the children are standing there just looking at me. You didn't want Daddy? And I say, shut your mouth. Get in there and eat your supper right now. Right now. Well, boy, they go. When you're in the house with a maniac, you mind. They sat down, and I go in and sit down with them, and I say, hurry up. Clean up those plates right now. Get it done. Boy, they eat. I said, get through. Now get up. Let's get the dishes cleaned up. You all get started. Get it cleaned up. I want every bit of it cleaned up. Right now. Mommy, you didn't want Daddy? I said, don't you talk about your daddy. Just get this cleaned up and get to bed. Ben, you heard me. Don't you talk back. Go to bed. Still daylight. They're in bed. And you hear the little chit-chat, chit-chat, you know. And then it's quiet. And then I start pacing the floor. And it gets dark. And it gets late. And I think, he might not come home this time. Maybe he really believed me. Why did I say all those things? What if he has a wreck? What if he kills himself? What if he kills somebody else? Oh, God, please. Please let him come home tonight. Just this one time. I won't do it anymore, God. I promise I won't. And I walk the floor and I look down the road and I wait for a car. And along around 10:30, I go in the bedroom and I jerk the covers back from two little children. I say, come on, kids, get up, get up. What's the matter, Mother? I told you to get up. Let's go. Where are we going, Mother? Daddy, where in the hell do you think we're going? Well, Mother, you ran him off. Get in the car. We're going to find Daddy. So we get in the car. And around every beer tavern, everything we can find, I'm driving and I'm saying, do you see the pickup? And they're praying they don't. Because they don't know what Mother's going to do. And then we get back home. And I wonder why they don't do well at school. It's because their father's an alcoholic. This is what I'm saying. We get back home, they go to bed, and I start the vigil again. And I prayed again so hard, just this time, God. Please. I won't ask you ever again. And Bob comes home. And I meet him at the back door and try to kill him with my bare hands. God answered my prayer, so I thought I'd just kill him. This is what I was. And then I wonder about the communication with children. I couldn't talk to them, and they couldn't talk to me. They couldn't talk to their daddy, and they talked to each other. And they looked at their mother and thought, what's wrong? You know what? And then the communication with friends. Oh, you don't have any friends. I had to cut those away. You can't have anybody just walking in and out of your house whenever they get ready. You know, not when there's a disease of alcoholism. Why, shoot. You know, they're going to come in. They might see something they're not supposed to see. I tell you, I just fall out when alcoholics talk about hiding a bottle and all the problems they've got. Listen, babies, did you all ever try to hide a live damn drunk? Now, that's what we did. And them things is hard to hide. They just crawl out everywhere. But I had cut away from the friends. I didn't want to see anybody, and I didn't want anybody to see me. My grocery shopping was at 8 o'clock in the morning. I didn't want them to ask me any questions about Bob, because I figured they knew something I didn't know. And then I was always wanting to find out what I thought they did know that I didn't know, you know. And then your own family. You have to cut away from the families. I went to my family, and I talked to them. I was my daddy's little girl, and there had never been anything that daddy couldn't fix. And I went in and sat down, and I said, would you all help me? Please. I can't live like this any longer. Do something. Please. And they both sat there quietly and then looked at me, and they said, Ramona, get out. Bob is a good boy. He just drinks too much. So get out. You see, my husband did not live up to the standard that my family had set for my husband. So I turned around and walked away. Because I couldn't say, I love this man. I love this man that doesn't come home. I love this man that doesn't provide for us. I couldn't even talk about love. Because really, I didn't know what it meant. But I didn't talk to them anymore. And then his family. I went to them. This was the answer. And I sat down and talked. This is your son. You love him. You can make him do something. You do something for him. Don't you know he's going to die? He's going to kill himself. And when I finished all my long recital, his mother looked at me. She said, well, Ramona, he wasn't an alcoholic when he married you. Heaven to Betsy, I hope not. And then there was the guilt. Somebody had spoken aloud what had been eating my heart up. Was I responsible? Did I do this? And I couldn't talk to them anymore. I didn't like the old hussy anyway. But that just gave me a good excuse. So I went home. And I was cut away. All away. No communication. Family, friends. And then was the communication that's the greatest loss of all. A communication with God. I knew of God, yes. I had heard of God, the God that my mother had talked about, and I'd heard at Sunday school about, and this was the God that sat up there, and he punished you if you were bad, and he rewarded you if you were good. And it was that simple. And I had prayed to this God, never once unselfishly, because I did not know the meaning of an unselfish prayer. I had never heard of an unselfish prayer. I just heard a prayer. And my prayer was always, give me a sober husband. Give my children a sober father. Give me shoulders to bear the cross, Lord. You know, make me strong. But never had it entered in my mind, God help this man. He hurts. So I prayed and prayed, God, do something. And nothing happened. So I figured it all out. The reason my prayers weren't being answered was because I wasn't good enough. If I was good enough, God would answer my prayers. So I set out to be good. And heaven help a man when his wife decides to be good. If he doesn't get drunk, he will. So I started in being everything to everybody. I took over the Brownie Scouts. I was a PTA. I was at church every time the door opened. Always close to the front, with a child on either side, devoutly praying, and hoping that there was a sunbeam lighting on my head. And all of the people in the church would say, God love her, isn't she sweet? And isn't it sad about that boy she's married to? And I took over their Sunday school class. I was going to teach Sunday school. And I told God, I just made a deal. Now I had begged, pleaded, and everything and nothing had happened. So I made him a bargain. I said, now look, God, I'll go to church, I'll teach your Sunday school, I'll carry your word, and you give me a sober husband. And I just taught Sunday school, and I went to church 3 times a week. I baked cakes, I baked pies, I gave, I did. And you know what happened? Bob was happier than ever. I was so busy at church, it gave him more time to drink. So, nothing happened. I did good, and nothing happened. So you know what I did? I quit the stinking church. I told God, I said, you can have your stinking church and your stinking Sunday school and all those people. I don't want any of it. A deal is a deal. And I don't give a damn who you make it with. You didn't keep your end of it, and I am through. And that was my last break in communication. How horrible. You know, it's better to have anything to pray to, anything, than nothing. Nothing. No hope, nothing to pray, just there, eaten alive on the inside. Well, this is a typical Sunday, and I won't tell you any more about me. But I think you need to know from whence I came. You know, many times we become discouraged with where we are. But if he will glance back to where from whence we came, then we get a glow in our heart and we realize, yes, it's much better today. Well, this was a Sunday morning that I didn't have anything to do with church. I was through with it. And I got up, and I had my long hair, and it came down below my hips. And at that day and age, girls, it was not fashionable, like it is now. And mine just hung, blue. It was not combed. And I put an old robe on. Had a few buttons missing down the front, and it came about halfway between my knee and my ankle. And I had an old pair of flopping house shoes. And Mother was up. And I really wanted him to realize how badly I looked. Bob did not hear me anymore, but if he could see me, I wanted him to know he was killing me. Just take one look, I'm half dead. Well, the kids got up and they wanted to go to Sunday school, and I didn't mind. I mean, if they wanted to, do it. Wasn't for me, but if that was their thing, get with it. So they got ready, and off they went to Sunday school, and Daddy drove them. Oh, Daddy loved to drive them to Sunday school, because he took them to Sunday school and let them out, and then he attended his service at the VFW. Now, the VFW was the only thing open in Sunday morning in Oglesby, Oklahoma, where you could get a drink. So that's where he spent his Sunday morning, and he picked them up, and he brought them home at noon, and everybody was happy. The kids had had a wonderful time. You know, it's a great, big, beautiful world out there. It's not like it is at home. And Daddy had really had a good time. It was just what he needed on Sunday morning. And there was Mama, just like they left me. I had not combed my hair and hadn't changed my clothes. And Robin says, "Mother, what's for lunch?" And I said, "Nothing." And I look at you-know-who, so they'll know why. We don't have any lunch. And I say, "Fix yourself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich." Well, they're used to Mother. I mean, you know. So they fix the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and they go in the breakfast room to eat. And Daddy joins them, and they're laughing and talking. And so I just went in and sat down. I wasn't about to have any of that in my house. I was miserable. I didn't have anything to laugh about, and nobody else needed to be laughing either. So I just joined them and broke up the party. Rusty said, "Mama, could we go to the picture show this afternoon?" And I said, "How? We haven't got any money." And I look at you-know-who, so they'll know why. We don't have any money. And Robin says, "Daddy, would you give us the money to go to the show?" Daddy said, "Sure, I'll give you the money." He just cashed a hot check at the VFW. We had tons of money. Then I said, "And how are we going to get there? Just how are you going to get there? I'm not going to take you. Not me." And this time I had settled halfway between town and out of town to cure him. And so we were about 4 miles from the movie. And Robin says, "Daddy, would you take us?" Ha-cha-cha. Daddy wanted to take them and every kid in town. He hadn't known how he was going to get out of the house to get back to the VFW. And there wasn't anything he'd rather do than take his kids to the movie and let them off. And I said, "But how do you get home? You're going to ask me, and I'm not coming. He takes you every time, but he never picks you out. And if you go this time, you're going to walk home. Don't call me." And they just get ready, and they start out the door, and I'm right behind them. "Don't call me. If he doesn't come after you, walk. I'm not coming." And they leave. I go back in the house and I slam the door and I pull the draperies and I went in and lay down on the bed in my bedroom and I cried because nobody loved me. Nobody. Nobody understood what I went through inside. Nobody understood the worry and the fear. They just didn't know. And I got to thinking about Robin was going to get married soon. Now, Robin was 12. And her daddy was going to be drunk at the wedding. And what was I going to do? And I cried about it. And then poor little Rusty. I mean, Rusty had to go to college. Every boy has to have a college education. Rusty was 9. And I didn't know how I was going to get him enrolled. I didn't have the money. So I cried about that. And they foreclosed on the house. And I moved down to the creek. And I lived in a tent. And all these things. And I cried all afternoon. And about 4:30 the phone rang. And I went to it and it was a little girl. And she says, "Mama, would you please come get us this one time? Daddy didn't come." Now, she was standing outside the theater booth holding the phone. And I gave a 15-minute dissertation on, "Didn't I tell you so? Your father is a drunk. You can't believe him. He lies. Don't ever get married." And I went on and on and on, and she would interrupt with, "Mother, this time, just this time, we won't ask you anymore. Please, Mama." I slam down the phone, and I run out, and I get in the car, and off I go to town. Hot summertime, windows roll down, and I'm still in my old robe and my house shoes, and the wind's blowing my hair out of the car. And here I go, right down Main Street, right up to the theater, and slam on the brakes and wait. And there are all the other mothers and fathers. picking up their children on Sunday afternoon, looking like parents are supposed to look. And then there's Ramona. They come out and get in the car, and Rusty lays down the floor of the back seat. He didn't want anybody to know I was his mother. Robin's a brave little soul. She sat right beside me, and right back down Main Street we go. And we get almost down Main Street, and there is the VFW. And I slam on my brakes, and Robin says, "Oh, Mama, no. No, Mama. Please, let's go home, Mama. Don't do this. Come on, Mama, just go home. Daddy'll be home." By this time, I've wheeled in, slammed on the brakes, the gravel's flying, and I've slammed the door, and Robin's laying down on the floor of the front seat. She didn't want anybody to know she'd be at the VFW. Now, the entrance to the VFW is right on Main Street, and up I flap, the old wind blowing that robe and the hair, and I press the buzzer. And the man comes to the door. Now, of course, the people are driving up and down, wondering what that is. The man opens the door and steps back, and he looks for my broom, which is usually come that way, you know. I'll have you know I didn't speak to that trash. Anybody would be a bartender. And I just went right through there, those old heels flapping and that robe flying and that hair going, right through the bar, and there's not a sound. Back through the ballroom and into the poker room. And there sits Bob around the table playing poker. And he looks up at me, and he pushes that cowboy hat back, and he looks sort of sick. And he says, "Hi, honey." I did not speak to a man that was so low to gamble off his money on Sunday afternoon. And I just gathered up my robe and I made me a little pocket. And I just rounded that table and I took everybody's money. I put it on. And then I stomped my foot. And I said, "We're hungry." And out I went. Back through the ballroom with my little pocket and my dimes and nickels and quarters jangling. Back through the ballroom into the car. And neither one of the children say a word. And I drive home as fast as I can go. And when I get there, I jump out and I run in. And I went right back to that same bedroom, and I slammed the door, and I threw myself on the bed, and I was violently sick. What had I done? What had I done? How could I do such a thing? There was no lengths that I would not go to try to humiliate somebody. I didn't know the meaning of the word humility. That was not even in my vocabulary. I hated myself. I had become a monster to fight a monster. And I could not stand me. Well, I decided I couldn't live that way anymore. So I asked Bob for a divorce. And he was tickled pink. He decided I was driving him crazy into drink. My family was pleased. His family were pleased. And there were two little children that just stood around and looked bewildered. Well, I had a very orderly life. I ordered it. And that was the only thing about it that was orderly. And about 2 weeks before the 6 months waiting period was up for remarriage, Bob came to me. Of course, he had been coming back and forth, getting the children on weekends. And the children had been playing Cupid, and I had been miserable. Because, you see, I had had things go wrong. And I didn't have anybody to blame them on. Now, an alcoholic is the greatest thing in the world to blame anything on. If you don't have one, go get you one. Because whatever happens, you can look at them and say, it's your fault. Well, I had things that didn't work out right. And the only reason was my fault. And I'd never been to blame for anything. And I wasn't about to start in then. So when Bob comes back and he sits down and he says, I'd like to talk to you, Ramona. And I said, yes, Bob. And he said, I think that we've played around long enough now. And I said, yes, Bob. And he said, I think that we should make a home for our children like they should have. And he said, let's have this divorce set aside. And I will control my drinking. Now, I had been living with an active alcoholic for 15 years then. And I had heard this Monday through Friday. He never said it on Saturday or Sunday. And I look up at him and smile and say, yes, Bob. So we go over to the courthouse and we get the divorce set aside. And two little children are waiting in the car. And when we come out, I'll never forget them. One with little blonde pigtails and a little Indian boy came tearing up. And they were waiting at that bottom step when we hit the floor. And they held us. With an alcoholic, they knew their mother was crazy. But it didn't make any difference. They loved us. And they made up their mind right then that they'd take care of us. We didn't have sense enough to take care of ourselves. Well, we went home, got a babysitter, and we went to a dance to celebrate the big reunion. And I'm drunker than he did. The next morning I awoke, and I didn't feel so good. I had a headache. But above all, deep down inside of me, I knew that I was right back right where I started. I had tried everything to make my husband not drink. My husband was an alcoholic. He had a compulsion, and it was alcohol. I was his wife, and I had an obsession to stop him. And that compulsion and that obsession damn near killed both of us. And I knew right then there was nothing that I had failed to do. And that was the greatest step I ever took. Because someone in this disease of alcoholism has to hit bottom sometime. And I hit mine. It is just as necessary that the mate of an alcoholic as the alcoholic hits bottom when they realize there is nothing more within their power they can do. And I did. And I knew there was nothing. And then this is the part of the story I like to talk about. You see, my God, as I understand him today, he lets me go just as far as I want to try myself. He never comes in uninvited. He loves me enough to keep me released and let me try. But that Father is always there, and he's always waiting when I'm ready to say, I've had enough. Well, things started happening because I was out of control. Bob and I went on a car wreck about 2 weeks later, on a trip about 2 weeks later, and I had a car wreck. And when I awakened, I was in a hospital, and there stood Bob. I can see him yet, blue shirt starched, those blue eyes shining, and I was bandaged up and cut up and bruised up, and he patted me on the shoulder tenderly. And he says, honey, everything happens for the best. And he didn't have a scratch one. And I looked up at him and I screamed, you son of a bitch! And they heard me all over the hospital. But how little I knew, it took a lick on the head for God to get my attention. I just don't get, you know, I just don't get a little tap. I need to know. That left me with a brain injury, and I traveled to many hospitals trying to get something done about it. Because I was left with seizures. And for 11 years, I would tell my story, and 11 years I've told, I was left with seizures. Because that's all I could say. I could not be honest enough with me. But you cannot stay around this program. You cannot associate with these people. You cannot be part of this fellowship that the honesty does not continue to grow and you constantly reveal more of yourself to yourself. What I am is an epileptic. That is what it left me. And it does not matter to you one difference a bit whether I am or am not. It matters to me because I must know what I am. I can't be painted pink like I wanted to be. That's what I am. It doesn't matter whether I was born an epileptic, I became an epileptic. This is what I am. And under certain conditions, I must conform or I cannot exist. And I can understand very well when an alcoholic says, I could not admit it. I know. I could not accept it. I know. Because I fought that very thing myself. And it is always important to me, not to you, but that I'm constantly aware of what I am. And accept me for what I am. Well, I think time is about up, but I'll have to tell you the end of the story, as far as it's gone. I grew to live with this and stayed busy. Oh, I stayed busy. I saw myself for what I was in a corridor of a hospital in New Orleans. I was awaiting brain surgery, and God allowed me to see me for what I was, not what I wanted you to think I was, not what I wanted to think I was, but for what I really was. He had given me hands, and these hands were to be gentle and show love and be tender. And I had made them into fists, and I had hit everything I loved and everything that came near me because I hurt so badly inside. He had given me a tongue, and this tongue was to give encouragement and to show love and to be tender. And I had lacerated a man and two children with the sharpest tongue in the world. But the greatest thing of all, he let me know he loved me, not because I was good enough to earn it, but because he was my father, and he loved me. I came home from New Orleans. There was no Al-Anon group in Okmulgee at that time. I didn't even know of Al-Anon, but I wanted to do something about me. I could not stand me. I knew then and that day that if there was, and if there ever would be, such a thing as a judgment day, and I would stand there, that I had no excuse when I said, I am married to an alcoholic. That gave me no right to be what I was. I was what I was because evidently that was the only way I knew to live. And I wanted to live with me comfortably and some form of serenity. Again, God stepped in, and don't think he doesn't. He always will. When the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear. And I was ready. And my next door neighbor sent me to her minister that I didn't even know. And said, maybe he can help you. And this young man knew all of the things you need to know about AA, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen. And he started in to help me. And I remember my first meeting very well. I walked in and I didn't know that's what it was. I thought it was just going to be counseling. And it was just Tom and me. And I walked in and he said, hi, I'm Tom. And he put out his hand. And I said, hi, I'm Ramona. And we shook hands. And he said, how about a cup of coffee? So we had a cup of coffee and sat down. And he says, now, how about you? So I started in immediately to tell him all about this man that I lived with that was an alcoholic. And he stopped me right there. He says, we're not here to talk about Bob. We're here to talk about you. So if you're going to an Al-Anon meeting, girls, where they serve roasted husbands. You're not an Al-Anon meeting. That is not Al-Anon. You are there to talk about you. And thank God Tom told me. He talked to me about the first step. And when he said, your power is over alcohol and your life has become unmanageable, I said, yes, my life is unmanageable. But I'm not powerless over alcohol because, you see, I'm not an alcoholic. And he said, I didn't ask you anything about you being an alcoholic. I said, you're powerless over alcohol. Because whenever it comes into your life, you have no control over your own actions. I could see that. I was a puppet on a string. Whenever alcohol came in any way into my life, I reacted. I had no choice. I simply reacted. I accepted that. He talked to me about the second step. Sanity was no problem. Not everybody goes in the VFW in their robe and steals money. So we went right by, and then he talked to me about the third step, and I didn't have any God. You remember that old God? He said, Tom said, Ramona, would you make a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of God as you understand him? And I said, no way. How? I made a deal with him and he didn't keep it. He says, you don't have a God, do you? I said, well, yeah. He says, not of your own. I ask as you understood him. And that was the key, as I understood him. He gave me homework. He told me that God loved Bob as much as he did me. And I said, that's a lie. I taught Sunday school and he was drunk. And I know I'm better than he is. So he told me to go home and read the story of the prodigal son. I came back. He said, now tell me about it. So I told him how great it was that the fellow went off, the son, and he drank everything and lived with the pigs and did all this stuff. And he came home, his father was so glad to see him. He says, you missed the point of the story. And I said, that's the point of the story. He says, no, do you remember about the brother? The brother that stayed home and thought he was so good. And how he felt when the prodigal son came back. Do you see any similarity between you and the brother? I did. He told me to let go and let God, and I said, how? I mean, I'd be tickled to death too, but how do you do it? He says, you let go and let Bob. Let Bob take care of what Bob has to take care of, and you take care of what you need to take care of, and let God manage it. Okay, this is great. But this time, we'd lost the ranch and the cattle and all this stuff, and so Bob had a job, and he traveled. Monday morning, I'd go to the door, and as Bob, I'd kiss him goodbye, and as he drove off, I'd wave. And then I'd look up, and I'd say, God, he's your boy. You love him more than I do. You take care of him all week. And you know, I'd have the nicest weekend, because I didn't have to worry about Bob. God has taken care of him. I didn't have to call him or hunt him or anything. And the children and I were speaking again. And I was being good to them again. And I was being happy again. And then Bob would come home on Friday evening, and I'd give God the weekend off, and we'd have hell on Monday morning. I seem to think he only worked a 40-hour week. Well, I talked to Tom about these unmanageable weekends, and he told me, he says, you know what? He's on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, from now into eternity. Why don't you just let him handle it? I didn't do these things easily. I fell down. I failed. But Tom was always there saying, get back up and try again. He was giving me what this program really does. Somebody there that says you can do it. He told me that those things in the book didn't mean a thing unless I did them. You can read them from now on, but until you do them, they mean nothing. Well, he told me the Serenity Prayer. I never will forget how he taught me the serenity prayer, and occasionally I almost say it that way. God grant me the serenity to accept the thing I cannot change, my alcoholic. The courage to change the thing I can, myself. He says, that's as far as you go. You don't have the wisdom to know the difference. Well, along about this time, he was telling me to be good and to not say things with resentment, and he was telling me to look better. He says, you know, Ramona, if I had a wife that looked like you, I wouldn't come home either. He says, you're God's child. Look better. Be happy. Don't put on Bob the burden of being your God. Release him. Look to where your God really is. Make no man the God in your life. You have burdened him until it is unbearable. He is a human being. He should not be in control of your happiness. You and your father. Let him go. Let him be. I tried these things, and as I said, days were good and days were bad, but I had more good days. Well, along about this time, I got real interested in faith healing, too. And I read everything I could read on faith healing. I read everything. I read all the time because that way I kept my mouth shut. Tom told me to not speak if I had resentment. And I had resentment, so I had to just shut up. Well, this was a Saturday night, and I was propped up in bed reading my book on faith healing. In fact, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I was on my beauty kick, and I'd been to the beauty shop and had my hair fixed. So I had a half a roll of toilet paper on it, and then an old rag stuck up there, and a lot of cold cream, and I was propped up in bed on Saturday night. Bob came in from the VFW. 1 o'clock in the morning. He comes to the bedroom, fixes himself a drink in the kitchen, comes back and sits down in the rocking chair at the foot of the bed, and he pushes his cowboy hat back, looks over at me and grins and says, what's you doing? And I said, I'm reading a book. He says, hell, I can see that. And then he made one fatal mistake. He said, what's it about? Well, I have been dying to talk to somebody about faith healing. But you don't just rush up to them and say, now, say, what do you think of faith healing? You know? And I said, well, faith healing works. He says, it does. Well, by this time, I laid the book down, and I was down on my hands and knees at the foot of the bed, looking at him in that rocking chair. And I said, yes, it works. It really works. Scientifically, it's been proven, medically proven, faith healing works. Now, I couldn't do it myself, but if I could get rid of all the fear and all the resentment and everything and become a channel for God, all I'd have to do is put my hand on you and say, heal, and you'd never take another drink again. Old Bob threw up both hands, fell out of the rocking chair, and he says, God damn you, don't you touch me. He didn't spill a drop of his drink. I tell you, I laughed until I hurt. And that was the first time I had laughed. You know, laughter leaves a home when the disease of alcoholism comes in. There's no laughter anymore. And I laughed deep down inside. Oh, what if somebody just walking along and looked in, you know, and all this. Oh, Lordy. And this is the greatest thing. I tell you, I go to conferences, and I hear the laughter. And I just bubble inside. You know, we laugh better and easier and deeper than any people in the world. You cannot have pure joy and laughter unless you've had deep sorrow. And we've suffered both. And now we laugh. Don't ever let it stop. It heals us. It's the thing that we come in here and we're so afraid and so alone. And we look and we see a smile and a sparkling eye and all that belly down laughter. And you just can't help laughing. Even if you don't want to, you laugh. Don't stop it. Well, you know what? Bob found AA. Not because of me, but in spite of me. And I was a charter member of the first Al-Anon group in Okmulgee. And that's been, this March is our birthday month, and 13 years ago, we started our first little group. Bob and I found a way of life we loved. We found people who understood us. We found the tenderness, the serenity, and the joy. And what did this program give us? It gave us a marriage. Because number one, we'd had nothing when we walked in here. He learned to love me and respect me. And I learned to love and respect him. And we had two children who learned to love and respect us both. And we didn't have anything to build on. We started anew, and you showed us how. And you walked away, and you led us. And life was good. Yes, we had things that were hard. You know, I have never read or heard that serenity is the absence of problems. But serenity is the ability to cope with problems. And you showed us the way to do that. And we lived well. And we were getting the things back that we had lost. And there was joy, and there was laughter, and there were people in that house, and there was a coffee pot, and there was cookies, and we were just busting out all over. And then I had cancer. And I was scared. And I begged again of this God. Oh, why me? Why? It's all so good. Why do you have to do this now? You see, I slipped. I didn't use my program. I immediately reverted right back to where I used to be. They did the surgery and they did cobalt. And I could not stand being locked in a room alone. And I would hang on for those minutes that they gave me cobalt and just hang on and say, God, let me do it. Just let me do it this time. I can do it. I can do it. And 30-some-odd treatments later, they opened the door and said, you don't need to come back. And Lenora walked out of there and she patted herself on the back. And I said, oh, gal, you can do it. You still got what it takes, haven't you? Some girl. Within a year, I had a recurrence. And when that telephone rang and they called me and said, we're sorry, Lenora. Yes. It's another malignancy. And we'll schedule you to go in the hospital Monday because we'll have to start cobalt again. And thank God I knew to do what this program told me to do. I walked in that room, closed the door, and got down on my knees. And I said, God, use me. This would have never come into my life again had I known what I needed to know. Will you teach me? Let me learn. Those treatments of cobalt were more severe and longer. And I thank God for every one of them. Every one of them. I looked forward to going. Because when I got in that room, and they turned that machine on, and I was alone, and there was a hum, and I had 3 minutes that I could talk to God. Not that I couldn't talk to him anywhere, in my car, in my house, at work, or play. But then it was just like a connection. And I let all this bubble out of me that I was afraid of, that I didn't want to die, that I wanted to see my children grown. I wanted to live. I wanted to give. And then it would stop. And they'd change positions, and it would be the same thing. And if my father was so good to listen to me for 3 minutes... could I not listen to him? No, I didn't hear great things. I didn't see flashes of light. All I can tell you, and this I say as a fact, is my heart glowed. And he let me understand that all in the world I have to give is my love. And if I give all of it, forever and ever and ever, I cannot give away one third. I cannot even touch the way he loves you. He loves you so. He stays alone so. He lets you wait until you want him. He never pushes in.
And when you see that sick AA alcoholic come in that door, or you see that sick Al-Anon walk in, that little old gal that didn't even want to come to a meeting. My God, she hated to walk in there. She tried everything else. Don't rush to her with steps and all of this to start with. Just walk up and love her. Let her know that you care. That somebody in this world cares. Then they'll stay. They'll stay till they learn the steps. They'll stay till they get our program. But they cannot do anything but feel. And you remember, don't ever forget how you felt. That's all I have to give away. And I'm so grateful I have it. 2 weeks after I took my last cobalt treatment, Bob took his first. And he'd never been sick a day in his life. And his was terminal. And then I saw the dignity and the depth and the scope of this fellowship. How did I live it? One day at a time. How was I strong enough? I was not. I was weak. But I didn't walk alone. Not one day did I walk alone. There were those there who showed me. This fellowship loved us. They gave us strength. They gave us courage. And they gave us a way to live. That we neither one lived in fear. And they allowed me to watch a man die in dignity that would have died drunk if it had not been for you. I didn't know where to place my feet. You didn't give me lectures. You just said, follow my path. There was never a time when I wanted to lie down in the bed and say, God, I can't stand it, that there wasn't a phone call. And all they had to say is, hi, just thinking about you and we love you. And that told me so much. Bob's been dead now practically 3 years. And what is my life today? I'll tell you what it's like. It's good. It's good. I've had to sell the ranch and the cattle and the horses and last my home. And I was quite wrapped up in that old house. And it was full of memories and I didn't want to part with it. But it was necessary because we're not allowed to hang on to the old. You see, that was a big old house and it had lots of fun. It was where Bob got sober. It had a lot of memories. But it didn't need just one woman rattling around alone. It had a big yard for kids and a barn for their ponies. And where am I? I'll have you know I'm dressed up in a floozy apartment with ruffles on the sheets. How about that for living? My son is married to a beautiful Greek girl. They live in western Oklahoma and I get to see them often. He works in the bank and I'm thrilled to death. I think maybe he'll learn enough to promote a loan for his mother. My Rusty looks like me and drinks like his father. But that's nothing that I have to worry about. You see, this program is not for me alone. And he's seen it work and he knows where to go. My daughter, the one that I thought was so terribly scarred that would never marry, would you believe, in December she married a handsome man, 6 years older. He has a 7-year-old blonde-headed son that he has custody of. So the day they said I do, I became an instant grandmother. And I am a hell of a mess. He goes to a few meetings with me, I believe, in starting them early. I have a job. A wonderful man that allows me to have weekends when anyone happens to ask if I could come. He understands. He was my husband's sponsor, but he didn't make the program. Why do I go to Al-Anon now? Because I need it. The very reason I walked in the door the first time, because I need it. I need to know how to release. I came here. I could not release anything. As a child, when I lived in the country, my mother raised baby chickens. And I can remember going home one afternoon, and that was a baby chicken day. And the chickens had all come. And I rushed out there, and I grabbed a little yellow chicken, and I held it tight, and it squirmed to get away. And my mother said, "Ramona, put the chicken down." And I thought, "You mean, oh, I'm not hurting your chicken." She says, "Put it down." So I laid the chicken down. And she says, "Now open your hand." And I did. And she picked up the little yellow fluffy chicken, and she set it in my hand. And it made no effort to leave. It pecked and pecked and pecked. It was perfectly comfortable and happy. And she said, "Always remember that. Hold what you love with an open hand." I had forgotten this, and I held everything I loved as close and tight to me as I could get it, because I didn't want to lose it. And it was only in this fellowship and the program of Al-Anon that I've learned how to open my hand and keep open and release what I love. It's here that I found a father that's always with me. Wherever I go, whatever I do, he'll be there. He will never move. I will be the only one that will stray. I want to keep these things. These are truths. These are the things that I live by. These are the things that make me serene. And again, my life is a series of opening my hand. My Indian father, that I love so dearly, that saddled my pony and rode in the bushes with me and sat by a bubbling creek and told me this way of life would end. They told me 2 weeks ago that he has cancer of the liver and it is terminal. And I went by Thursday to tell him goodbye because I wanted them to understand that my father, my heavenly father, cares for my earthly father much more than I. He will hold him with tenderness, and he'll take him to him. And all I must do is be ready and willing to let him have it. Did I need you?
Yes.
You didn't need me this weekend. You'd had a perfectly beautiful conference whether I ever showed up or not. I needed you. I have to keep my hand open. I have to keep my heart open. I have to have a path to follow. I have to hear the love and the joy and the beauty. I have to soak it up. And where can I get it but from those I love? I thank you for what you are. But most of all, I thank you with all my heart for what you make of me when I'm with you. Thank you.